Today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a 90-year-old ex-prisoner of war remembers bailing out of the wounded B-17 he was piloting about 10 seconds before it exploded.
I said, God, don't let him kill me. And that was my prayer on the way down.
That prayer was answered, and he hasn't taken life for granted. We'll hear about his recent adventures through a program called Honor Flight. That's Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday on KMJ. Each week we visit with veterans, hoping to honor them for their service and recognize the sacrifices they made for the sake of our freedom. Mostly we hear from our greatest generation, veterans of World War II, and it's so important that we preserve those stories so they're not forgotten. I know I learn a lot in the process, I'm pretty sure you do too, and I am really excited about the program today. As we look to the past, we're also going to look to the future a little bit, and a program that I hope we can bring in full force here to Central California. Before I get to that, if you haven't heard yet, the B-17 Memphis Belle will be in Fresno tomorrow, Sunday, April 14th. It was so great to pick up the Fresno Bee this week and see a picture of my friend Rudy Giannone, one of my favorite people in Fresno. You've heard him on this program here before. He's going to be 90 later this month, and there he was, back up in the air in a B-17, 68 years after he was shot down and became a prisoner of war. That B-17 will be at the Fresno airport tomorrow. I've got a link on our website at kmjnow.com with more information about that. We're going to hear from another ex-prisoner of war on today's show. He flew B-17s in the war. He's 90 already. And the flight he took recently was not in a B-17, but in a modern jetliner. He went to Washington, D.C., and the World War II Memorial through a terrific program called Honor Flight. It's a nationwide program. Again, links at kmjnow.com if you want to research it while you're listening. But Honor Flight does not have a hub in Fresno yet, and I think you can help me make that happen. Bakersfield has one. In fact, Kern County Honor Flight is in our nation's capital with a group of veterans right now. They're going to have a big welcome home tomorrow in Bakersfield. We've had veterans from the Fresno area go on honor flights, but to do it, they've had to work through other areas of our state. They've had to travel just to travel. If you want to help me get it started right here with Honor Flight, I hope you'll contact me at KMJ. But right now, we're going to hear from a guy who has walked this path in Reno, Nevada. John Yuspa of Honor Flight Nevada joins us now. We'll get a little bit of his story before we hear from our veteran today. All right. Well, first of all, and our listeners have heard me talk about Honor Flight a time or two, and we've heard from many veterans from all over the country who have been on Honor Flights. But we still haven't made it happen here in Fresno. You think that's a good idea, John? Your experience with Honor Flight, is it worthwhile for our community to get involved in a project like this?
Absolutely. You should do whatever it takes, short of robbing a bank. These men and women are valuable to the community. They're so humble. They've provided their services. They sacrificed their lives. And for us to pay back with something small as a little trip to honor them, and it's just a matter of you need to get some of the right people to step up from the community to help you put this together. 30 days. In 30 days, if you can't get this together, you know, something's wrong. But Fresno is such a great community. You have great people together. It's not expensive. People will donate money. You know, we've done little things at the Walmarts and the Sam's Club, just nickels and dimes, and to the big grants. But just get the right people together. The fire department, the police department have helped us tremendously. The airport, everybody, every veterans group from the Marine Corps League, the VFW, they'll find people that are real active in their organizations just to get on board. So you shouldn't be sleeping tonight.
Well, and our community, the whole Central Valley, there are just so many great organizations that love veterans and do a lot for them. So I know the willpower is there. But maybe we need an example of how it's possible. So I want to hear your story. When did you first get involved with Honor Flight?
I got involved about 5 years ago in Baltimore. I worked for one of the airlines and just saw all these planes.
You can say the name.
Okay, Southwest Airlines. I know we don't fly to Fresno, but...
Fresno wants to change that. Fresno wants it real bad, yeah.
Start writing in those letters now. But I just started volunteering, helping load and unload and go into D.C. with these hundreds of veterans. A lot of them were in wheelchairs. They just need extra hands. And 2 years ago, I moved out to Reno, Tahoe area. And I just tried to volunteer with one of these groups. Come to find out, there wasn't an Honor Flight program in Reno or the state of Nevada. So long story short, we've started a program out here about a year and a half ago. We dragged our feet, but, you know, somebody kicked us, and we finally got going. We took our first trip in October, 35 veterans. And now the regret is, why didn't we do it faster and sooner? So it's something that, you know, anybody listening should just get on the phone and just start making this happen. And we're here to help if need be.
And so you took the one flight, and now what are the plans moving forward?
That was our first year. We took one flight. We didn't really know what we were doing too much. We pulled it all together, got a bunch of volunteers, a lot of great donors. The community came together, and that was 35 veterans in October. And this year our plans are 6 to 8 trips for Nevada, hopefully more, but those are our good goals, and everything's on track. We've got hundreds and hundreds of applications that come in all the time from World War II, Korean, and all veterans. And we're getting phone calls every day from people to help, from the media to sponsors or volunteers or retirees. It's the smallest things people think that, you know, you don't need. But whether somebody can donate printing or phones or answering phones or just calling these veterans just to let them know that you've gotten their application, means a lot.
With that first flight, what were some of the neat things that you saw happen along that journey from Nevada all the way out to Washington, D.C., as these veterans started spending time around each other and experiencing this together?
The trips are amazing. Every trip has the same magic quality. The one we went from Reno to Baltimore, within the first hour, we had veterans that have never met each other in their entire lives. Come to find out, two veterans were flying side by side in the same mission. One was shot down that day and became a POW, and this was their first time sort of reuniting. We had a brother and sister that had left the Indian reservation at the beginning of the war to serve, and they left, you know, the reservation into, you know, to a whole new surrounding, but they wanted to serve America. Husbands and wives that went on the trip, it becomes an instant brotherhood and sisterhood. These groups have something of instant connection. They can talk about things that they've never talked about. There's no judgment. Their family isn't around. Spouses aren't there for one particular reason. Just it's all about the veteran experience. And in this trip, they will open up. And the joke around the group is that a lot of these men and women have never talked about their experiences in war. And we'll get a phone call from the family that basically says now they won't shut up. They just feel so comfortable about sharing their experiences.
And it's more than just getting to the World War II Memorial, which would be enough. It's spectacular, and it's so moving for so many veterans. But you have school children involved, writing letters to these veterans. You have receptions. Give us some of the big picture of all the things that make this a real special event for the veteran and make them feel like, yeah, I really did something important.
The trip that we do out of Nevada, which would be pretty similar to your trip, it's a 3-day trip just because of the logistics and flying. The first day, I mean, the 3-day trip is kind of like a replication of a mini service, like a mission. We leave on a Friday morning. Their family takes them to the airport and says goodbye, just like they still do today. And, you know, they're going off to service. We don't tell the veterans all the bells and whistles they're going to see. We land this next trip in May from Las Vegas. I'm sorry. We will land and we'll take them to the Naval Academy for dinner and a tour. We will start Saturday morning. That one will have a motorcycle escort. by the police department for the entire 8-hour day. So they get that special privilege of going through traffic lights and not waiting in traffic. We'll see all the monuments. We have care packages from the kids, the baked cookies and all kind of things. So there's care packages like when they were serving. There is a mail call. So they get mail from friends and family and complete strangers talking about their service and their sacrifice and thanking them, which is important. We go to Arlington. We see the changing of the guard. We have some special treatments there. We see all the branches of their monuments and memorials. We spend the day with all kind of little segments. And we have a big dinner. Everybody gets a chance to really just spend time with each other and bond, and they get to meet other veterans that are on the same trip from other cities. Sunday, we do a little bit of activities in the morning, Sunday, and we fly home, and there has been a connection that they feel that other veterans won't understand outside of the Honor Flight veterans, because they've, in a 3-day trip, they've connected to people they've never met, and now they're friends for life. We do the homecoming, which is the whole community comes out to give them the homecoming and the thank you they've never gotten. And it's not just for this group that's on the plane. It's for the community back home. It's for the Vietnam veterans that never got it, that are part of the community. It's for everyone. But what people don't understand is the veterans never asked for this. Some of them are embarrassed. It's very emotional. They're put on a pedestal this whole weekend, and they're treated like rock stars, as they should be. But their family would never have seen this. So even if they had gotten these ticker tape parades, you know, in the 40s, their great-great-grandkids, their next-door neighbors, their mailmen weren't around. So now they get to see a member of their community treated with respect and honored. So it's everybody gets to see everybody in a different light. And it's just rewarding for everyone involved.
And I know it's really rewarding for you. When you think about the things that people have said to you, after this is all over, the kind of feedback that you get, what's the most meaningful thing or the most neat thing that someone has shared with you?
We hear a lot from the family how much mom or dad, grandma, grandpa have opened up. They've never shared experiences or never shared stories. They were embarrassed to even talk. There's a lot of people that don't know their family or relatives or neighbors were even in the service. It's just a different chapter in their lives. So for them to, you know, have their grandkids on their lap and finally tell stories, and it's a different person, their family, they've never seen this side, is rewarding. I mean, it's, you know, they understand their station in life. They, you know, they'll tell you themselves that they're in their final chapters, but this has helped to rewrite the final chapter.
Is there anything that you've learned through your involvement with Honor Flight that you don't think you would have understood without this experience?
Well, you definitely agree it is one of the greatest generation. Every person on this trip instantly becomes a relative. They're your grandmother, grandfather, aunt or uncle. They're all warm. They ask for nothing. They don't want to go on this trip. They don't know why people would even do this for them. So they're very humble, and you learn those good qualities, you know, just to do for your community because it needs to be done and it should be done, not for self gratification or glory. It's just, there's a lot of things that we've overlooked in our fast-paced lives, but the respect and, you know, that needs to come back.
Is there anything else you think we ought to know about Honor Flight?
It should be coming to Fresno before the end of April.
No pressure. Thanks a lot, John. When I welcome in now 90-year-old Al Porta of Reno, Nevada, a World War II veteran who spent 7 months as a prisoner of war. But I want to start way before that, Al. You grew up in Pacific Northwest in Spokane, Washington. What was it that gave you a bug for flying early on? Because I understand your first flight was as a teenager.
Yes, I was doing yard work for a doctor in Spokane, and I looked up and an airplane flew over. And I told the doctor, I said, that's what I want to be. I want to be a pilot. I have to get 2 years of college. And then I get into the Air Force program. But the war broke out after that, before that, so I didn't have to do the 2 years of college before I went in.
Would you have been in Spokane for December 7th, 1941? Do you remember hearing about Pearl Harbor?
I was working for Boeing for right after high school. I went over to Seattle and was working for Boeing, and I was on the swing shift and walking by the bridge and hear soldiers all over the bridge. And I says, what are you guys doing here? I said, haven't you heard? And they just bombed Pearl Harbor, you know. So that's where I was.
What did that do to you? What kind of impact did that have on you?
The impact was you know, talking to the other guys, what are we going to do, you know, and said, well, let's enlist. What do you do when the war breaks out? At that time, I was going to University of Washington, taking a couple of classes there. November, we signed up.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but just with what you've told me, I'm guessing you didn't have to go. I mean, you could have had an exemption to work for Boeing or to go to school.
That's correct. I didn't want that because that was my goal is to fly military airplanes.
And most guys I talked to, everybody that signed up for the Army Air Corps wanted to be a pilot, whether they ended up as navigators or bombardiers or whatever. They all wanted to be pilots. But most of the guys say they wanted to be fighter pilots. Is that what you wanted to do?
I put in for single-engine fighter, twin-engine fighter, night fighter, and I got B-17s, four engines, you know, because you want your destiny covered by your thumb on the guns, you know. You know, because when I got shot down, I didn't see any of those fighters. All I saw was my number three engine on fire.
Tell me about your first flight in a B-17. What did it feel like to have that big, expensive piece of equipment and other people on board? That's a pretty big responsibility for a young man.
Well, didn't think of too much at that time because you had your sights set on going to war and flying bombing missions. I turned 21 in February, graduated from pilot school in March, and was overseas in July of that year after about 50, 60 hours in the B-17 when we picked up our crew. Took the crew, went to Kearney, Nebraska, picked up a brand new airplane, and flew overseas. Flew out of Gander, Newfoundland, to Ireland, no problems.
Well, let's pick things up there after this break. A 21-year-old B-17 pilot flying bombing missions out of England. We'll find out how Al Porta got shot down, what he experienced as a POW, why he returned to the service after all of that, and why he continues to serve veterans today. We'll explore those topics when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, hearing today from 90-year-old Al Porta of Reno, Nevada, originally from Spokane, Washington. We're going to hear about his experience with Honor Flight, but first, the missions he flew in B-17s during World War II. So you're 21 years old, and you're flying bombing missions out of England with the 457th Bomb Group, 21 years old, and you've got, what, a 10-man crew that you're responsible for?
That's correct. They were all great guys. I lost three of them the day I was shot down because I had a fire in Bombay. My number three engine was on fire, and probably my number three tank was also ruptured, and the fuel was flowing into the Bombays. Because when I opened the Bombay door, the fire just engulfed me. So the only thing I could do was just jump out. Because that was my exit for bombing, is to go back through the airplane and see that everyone got through, got out. But I couldn't do that because of the fire in the Bombay.
We're talking about November 2nd, 1944, your 17th mission. So you had these 16 missions. Had you had some close calls before that? Had you been shot up a little bit in those first 16 missions?
Yes, I'll give you an example of two of the hairiest ones. About the 12th mission there, my waist gunner got a piece of flak right in the pressure point of his leg. Some of it went back in the waist area, and the blood was flowing profusely out of his left leg. So we put a tourniquet on him. It was 40 degrees below zero. He'd lost so much blood by that time that I was afraid he'd lose his leg. So we pulled him into the radio room and put him up on his foot. We had electric muffs that we used to stick our hands into. And it was maybe 10 degrees warmer in the radio room than it was in the waist gunner's position. That was the coldest position of the waist gunner. So then we got back to the cockpit. I pulled the crew, asked him, I said, he's going to lose his leg if we don't get him down where it's warmer. And I'm asking you guys, is it pretty risky because we have to hit the deck and go home alone without any fighter escort? And they all voted to hit the deck. So after we hit the deck, I ordered the ball turret gunner and all the other gunners to take their crash position. Because I said, if we get attacked, I'm going in. I'm going to crash land the airplane. So fortunately, we didn't get any attacks. And we got a little ground fire. Some of the guys reported some ground fire other than that. But that was 5 hairy hours on the deck.
So you were able to make it all the way back to England flying how low off the ground?
50 feet, maybe.
You know what you just said, but I want to make sure all our listeners understand what you just said. Basically, you're saying here you have the luxury of a formation and fighter escort that you could take all the way home with you, and this guy might lose his leg. Or you could put the other 9 lives on board in jeopardy to get him back safely and save that leg, and you guys chose to put your own lives on the line to save his leg.
That's correct.
What did that say to you about the kind of men you had on board?
Well, they were, like I say, they were great. From the day I met them, all of them were eager to fight. Every day when we had a mission assigned, no arguments, packed their gear and get in the airplane, away we'd go. And we had another mission. Ooh, that must have been about 14. Was it very close to the time that Goris got injured. And on that mission, as I was forming up over England, I lost the turbo on number 2 engine. I didn't think that was a reason to abort the mission, so we went on. Got over the target, my number 1 engine started to, prop started to run away. The prop control was malfunctioning, so the only way I could control that is with a feathering button. What the feathering button does, when you lose an engine, it feathers a prop, so it reduces drag. But I used it to control the prop. We got the bombs away, and I told the navigator, I says, well, pick it out closest to our friendly lines, and because we got ahead there, we can't keep up with the formation. He says, okay, turn right. About 30 degrees or something like that. I had no more turned right, and a piece of flak. I got a flak right number 4 engine. So that one was dead. So I feathered number 4. So now I'm flying with number 1 running away, number 2 turbocharged, which is only about half the horsepower at 30,000 feet. I had one good engine, and number 4 was feathered. And there again, I says, guys, I can't keep up with the formation. We got to hit the deck, so same procedure, hit the deck, took their crash positions, and got back home.
You described that so calmly, but again, you're a 21-year-old kid with all these other lives that you're responsible for. How nerve-wracking was that to go the rest of the way back to home base, and what were you doing up in that cockpit? Are you clenching your teeth? Are you saying a prayer? Are you closing your eyes? What are you doing?
Not too much. You got your hands full flying the airplane, and you kind of looking out for ground fire, especially when you're close to the deck. And you're concerned about it, but not much I can do about it. I don't have any guns other than a .45 in my shoulder harness that I can use.
That's about a week before you end up being shot down on your 17th mission, but I'm wondering, had that stuff starting to started to wear on you? Did you ever find yourself afraid that each mission would be your last?
I was 21 years old, you know. You're indestructible at 21. I would go into town and hit the bars, nights off. So when I'd come home at night, we had three crews in our hut. Some of them still be up crying. It'd be 2 o'clock in the morning. I'd jump in my bunk and go sound asleep. Like I say, I was too young to have any fear.
And I guess that served you well. Well, tell me about that 17th and final mission. Your target was Merseburg, Germany?
Everything was pretty normal. Our navigator took us about 30 miles off course. Well, that took us out of fighter protection. So the Germans spotted that right away, and they come up in 109s, and they knocked down 9 of us. There again, helpless, no guns to shoot. I don't know what's going on. I know that they're shooting at the fighters by the vibration of the airplane. When I saw number 3 engine was on fire, feathered the prop, and that didn't stop the fire, and gave the order to bail out. So right after I gave the order, I dropped down to the lower part of the airplane, opened the door to the bomb bay, and it was completely engulfed in fire and burned my face and hands. Slammed the door and jumped out. The hatch is right there. As I was floating down, it was real quiet in the airplane, but as soon as I was out there, I could hear the zoom of the engines and the rattle of machine guns. And the fighters had come to our rescue, our American fighters. I didn't want to get in the middle of that, so I didn't pull my ripcord. There was an undercast, so I waited until I got in the clouds below me before I pulled the ripcord and sailed down.
And you said you got burned in the face, so you could still see okay?
Yes. I had my glasses on, fortunately, so burned my forehead, my cheeks, my nose, and lips.
So as you're floating down, are you looking around to see how many other parachutes are out there, or what are you doing?
Yeah, you're looking all around, and I could see other planes going down. I didn't see our airplane explode, but it exploded. It was reported that it exploded about maybe 10 seconds after we bailed out. No, I said, God, don't let them kill me. And that's what was my prayer on the way down.
Where'd you land? Where'd you come down?
Come down in a little farming community in Blankenheim, Germany. Fortunately, we ran into the Volkssturm, the old guard. The German seniors were not committed to the front lines. They just did police work. We had guards that were that way, and they were very reasonable people. We got along real good with them. I was very fortunate that they were there, because some of the guys got picked up by the SS, and they didn't make it to prison camp.
Just about every POW I've interviewed that was a prisoner of war in Europe anyway has told me he was greeted by the same words from the Germans who found him. What did they say to you when they found you?
For you, the war is over.
They were pretty consistent with that. So what's going through your mind? I mean, I'm sure you hadn't planned on being captured and being a prisoner of war.
Pretty much in shock. The pain in my hands and face with no treatment in sight. That was probably the most miserable 3 days I ever spent in my life. We ran into other prisoners, and I couldn't even feed myself. They had to feed me, take me to the bathroom, and I probably was in shock for 3 days. You could say that. I have a good memory of, you know, what we were doing. I remember going to a farmhouse there, and they looked at my hands and shook their heads, and that's all they said. Didn't say anything. I was hoping I'd get some butter or some kind of grease to put on to stop the pain. I couldn't make them understand that. So.
When did you finally get some relief?
About 3 days later at Frankfurt.
Frankfurt's where the infamous interrogation center was. So how'd that go down?
They weren't too hard on me. Name, rank, and serial number. They told me more about myself than I told them.
Were you surprised by how much they knew about you?
Not really. We'd been briefed on their tactics, so we were always instructed what to say, what not to say.
Were you confident that you were going to be treated all right? Were you scared that you might die in captivity. What do you think was going through your mind?
I don't believe that I was scared. Probably a little apprehensive about what the future was going to be, but stayed pretty calm all through the ordeal.
How long was it till you found out anything about the other guys on your crew?
Oh, I didn't find out until I got back, was liberated, and I flew back to my old bomb group, and my gunner was there who had the injury to his leg, and he told me that the three crew members were killed. But he thought they had bailed out and the SS got them, but later reports were they went down with the airplane because the Germans reported the dog tags of one of the gunners by name, so I knew that he burned up in the airplane. He was a ball turret gunner, so I assumed the other two burned right with him.
And I bet you were hoping that when you got to a prison camp, you might see somebody from your crew or somebody from your bomb group or somebody you knew.
I'd seen some of them at Frankfurt. I saw the navigator and the bombardier, and they had seen the tail gunner because we all bailed out in the same area and just different groups. But we all converged at Frankfurt, and at Frankfurt, boy, they put me in the hospital there and treated my hands and face.
So you're being held by the enemy and dependent on them for medical treatment. How did they treat you? Did you sense some compassion in their medical people?
Yes, absolutely. They took real care of me, good care of me. No painkillers. They put my hands in a purple solution, soaking there. Took a tweezer and pulled all the skin off my hands. So that was testy, but I knew that they would heal.
Good old gentian violet, huh?
I don't know what it was. Is that what they called it? A disinfectant of some kind. But I didn't get any infection, even after the 3 days. They were swollen bad.
So they take you to Stalag 3A. Tell us where that was and what that journey was like.
Well, that was mostly by train, that we didn't have to walk.
40 and eights?
Yes. The Stalag 3 was filled up with American Stalag 3, so Stalag 3A was for the Australians, New Zealanders, and the English. Some of those guys had been there since the war began, 5 or 6 years. So I remember the one groupie saying, if I'm in this prison camp another year, I'm going to cut my throat.
So did they show you the ropes a little bit?
Oh, yeah. They really told us what was going on. We were interrogated to make sure that we weren't German spies. Of course, the fact that my hands were still bandaged, my face was still bandaged, they pretty much figured that I was an American. We had a good security system. We had a radio. Got the news. We knew what was going on.
You probably had to hide that radio, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we had. I think we had two or three of them in the compound there. And how we got those, some of the enlisted men scrounged from some of the civilians around the area there, radios, and brought them into camp. The Germans wouldn't let the officers work. Only the enlisted men went out to work. But, God, they got better rations than we did. Plus, the time went faster, you know.
So what was your existence like in that camp?
Well, you get a bunch of 21-year-olds in a room 24/7, and we had the goons, we called them, the guards. The barracks had slats in it about an inch apart, and we could see them down there and hear them crawling around because they wanted to listen to what we had to say. So we got cold water and started pouring it through on the floor. And we'd hear them cussing, crawling out from under there. So, we get 21-year-olds, a bunch of them together. They can think of all kinds of mischief to think about and talk about. So mostly we talked about food.
Just dreaming of the food you might have when you got out?
Yes, how we could survive on just going to a restaurant and ordering a cup of coffee. And put a half a pound of sugar in and have all the energy we needed.
Yeah, dreaming about food was a good way to pass the time, but what about the food Al and his fellow prisoners actually had to eat? We'll hear about that, find out about Al's liberation, and also the adventures he's had recently, 90-year-old ex-prisoner of war, Al Porta of Reno, Nevada, our guest today. Back after this with the rest of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
Hey, Bulldog fans, Paul Leffler here, coming to you not as the voice of the dogs, but as a husband and father of two. Ever have a hard time finding a restaurant that's family-friendly, won't set you back a week's pay, and has the kind of food that makes you want to keep coming back? I think I found it. And no, it's not one of those chains. It's one of a kind. Luna's Pizzeria, an Italian restaurant on Pulaski Avenue in Old Town Clovis. The Liberta family's been serving up great, authentic Italian food in the heart of cowboy country for more than 40 years. The pizza dough is made from scratch daily, and so is the bread. You won't forget the bread. I'm a sucker for that bread and the meatballs and the ravioli. And hey, did I say family friendly? How do you top a kid's menu with nothing over $3.95, drink included? I'm not making that up. See for yourself at lunasclovis.com. And while you're there, check out the family meal deals. That's lunasclovis.com or 299-4141. Tell them I sent you. And if you really want to, bring me back some bread. Luna's Pizzeria and Italian Restaurant. You'll love it at Luna's.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, bringing it in for a landing now with 90-year-old Al Porta of Reno, Nevada. He was a B-17 pilot in World War II. We've heard about how he was shot down on his 17th mission with the 457th Bomb Group back in November of 1944. He became a prisoner of war. And let's talk now about the gourmet cuisine you enjoyed as a guest of the Gestapo. I've heard stories about the bread made out of mostly sawdust. What kind of food did you guys have?
That was it. Black bread and sauerkraut. Now, I had the recipe. I don't have it with me for black bread. I think they had beets in there and, like you said, sawdust.
Or tree flowers, they called it, huh?
Tree flower. That's right. Wood chips. Whatever they could find or stir into it.
And how much did you weigh when you were captured, you think?
I was about 210. Went down to 150, about 10 pounds a month.
And as those weeks and months go by, were you able to keep your spirits up? Were you starting to get a little hopeless, demoralized? How did that work for you?
I don't think I ever got hopeless because, like I say, we had radios and we knew that it was just a matter of time. In fact, the groupie said, no, we're not going to try to escape because it won't be long. The Americans or the English will be here. Liberate us. We just went by the news all the time because just before, maybe 6 months before I got there, they had three tunnels dug out of the prison. 66, I think, got out and they were captured and Hitler ordered them killed. So they killed 66. So, and then they found the other tunnel. So that was the end of that escapade. So
you knew you weren't escaping. I'm just curious what it was that kept you believing things would be okay. I mean, was it just the strength in numbers with the other POWs? Was it something about your upbringing, your faith? What do you think it was?
I guess it was more or less my upbringing, my faith. Prayed to God every day. So.
Did your family know you were a prisoner?
They knew I was missing in action. That's all they knew.
You had a situation, I think it was in January of 45, right, where they got you up and marched you 42 miles in a little more than a day?
Yes. The Russians were coming up on the Eastern Front. They ordered us all out of there. At 2 o'clock in the morning, we fell out, grabbed all the, if we had any grub left, and started walking. Like I say, we stopped in a farmyard and rested for 3 or 4 hours a couple times and kept right on plugging. And then we got on 40 and 8s and headed for Moosburg, which is south of Munich. And that's where we were liberated by the 6th Army. That was 1st of June.
So that was a different prison camp they took you to in Moosburg?
Yes, it was. It was called 7A.
Were the conditions there any different from what you'd experienced?
They were worse. Just had tents to sleep in.
In the worst winter that that continent had seen?
Yes.
So how did you stay warm at night?
Well, just wrap up. You know, we did have wool coats that they issued us. And just wrap up in your wool coat and pull your feet in, sleep.
What do you think is the worst thing, the most difficult thing that you had to endure?
I think it's psychological. Yeah. It's psychological. You can only get so scared. And then after that, you got to say to yourself, am I going to go crazy or am I going to get out of this? You know, so you make up your mind right there that you're going to go with the flow, trust in God, that you're going to get liberated without getting killed.
And when did you realize that that Liberation Day was getting near?
We thought it was going to be a month sooner, but then they had the Battle of the Bulge, and that stopped everything pretty much, our progress there. So then when it got ginned up again, then we had hope.
What do you remember about that day? Did the British come right through the gate? Did the Germans abandon the camp? How did that go down?
A bunch of guys come through there on jeeps. The guards had all left the night before, so we knew that the army was coming in. When the guys come in, we stole all our sea rations that they had. Ate all our rations that they had.
Did you make yourself sick?
Oh, no. No. One guy died. I think we had donuts and eggnog at the harbor there in Le Havre where we're shipping out of. And one guy, I guess, ate too many donuts and died of acute indigestion.
So how great did that feel when you had lived 7 months as a prisoner to taste freedom again? What did that feel like?
Well, it was so great. Really, really great, and immediately you start thinking about other things after that, about your career, girls, food. They had other things to occupy your mind as soon as you were liberated. You didn't dwell on that. The only thing that bothers me is losing those three kids. They were 18 years old when I went to the war memorial, and they had the stars for them. Those killed in action. I said three of those stars belonged to my crew members, and little did I know that each star was 100. But I said they deserve one big star.
And I want to talk to you about that because you took the honor flight. But what was it like to finally get home? You said you went back to your bomb group first, but to finally get back to America and to see your family again and have them realize you aren't dead out there somewhere, you're alive. What was that like for you?
Well, that was really great. My mother was very weepy. She cried all the time. And I'm sure it was her prayers that kept us alive, because I had a brother who was a P-38 pilot, and he finished up his tour in Europe and came home. Another brother was in the 1st Marine Division. He made 3 landings in the South Pacific, and he came home alive. So we all said it was her prayers that brought us all back alive. Because we lost our whole neighborhood, you know. A lot of them we lost at Pearl Harbor, because the kids in those days joined the Marine Reserve just to make $7 a month. And before the war was even started, they were in Pearl Harbor, you know. A lot of them were killed in Pearl Harbor.
Well, it is something that all three of you brothers came home, because all three of you face some serious stuff with what you did during the war. Another question I have before we get to honor flight. So you go through all this, you're a POW, but you stay in the military afterwards? Were you a glutton for punishment? Did you feel like you had something to prove?
I like to fly.
Yeah.
I like to fly. So I was flying, and my first assignment was ferrying airplanes out of California to Utah. Then I was assigned to Randolph Field as a flight instructor. I was there 4 years.
And you went from flying 4-engine B-17s in the war to flying giant jets like B-52s later on. Did you have a favorite airplane that you ever flew?
B-25. I had a lot of instrument work on in the B-25. I loved that thing. I could take it any place, and during any weather conditions, it would take a real beating and still keep on chugging. That was my favorite airplane. I like the B-17. After I finished my tour as a flight instructor, I was assigned to the Berlin Airlift. So I went to Great Falls, Montana, and checked out in C-54s. And when I finished my training, they tore down the barrier, so I didn't have to go to. And that time, I didn't see any good at flying assignments, so I elected to get out and finish school.
But you stayed in the reserve, and you got called back up for Vietnam?
Yes, I did.
In all those years in the military and everything you did, is there something that you're most proud of or that gives you the most satisfaction to say, this is what I did for my country?
Yes, it does. I volunteered at the VA for the last 10 years.
What do you do down there?
I serve coffee in the morning on Wednesday and Tuesday. I work with the blind veterans in their any sports activity that they want to participate in, bowling mostly, shuffleboard, golf. People say, how can you teach a blind guy to play golf? Well, I'll show you. Come on out Tuesday at the driving range and I'll show you that they can hit the ball.
That's awesome. And I see you're wearing the hat from the Golden Age Games. Have you been a competitor?
Yes, I've competed in the last 4 years.
What events?
I golf and horseshoes, ping pong.
Got any medals?
Yes, I have a whole stack of them.
And let's talk about Honor Flight. So you went on the first Nevada Honor Flight back to the World War II Memorial. You actually met a guy on the plane. You got 33 veterans on there, and another one flew some of the same missions you did?
When I saw him, I said, what were you doing November the 2nd, 1944? He says, I don't know. He said, and he had a list. He said, we went to Merseburg that day. Well, I said, yeah. I got shot down that day, and as I was floating down in my parachute, I said, you went by and gave me the way. I was just kidding him, because there were 1,000 airplanes going there, still flying. So we lost 9 out of our group, 36.
But I know that was special to meet someone that had been there with you.
Because it was just like meeting God, you know. Nobody flew 35 missions and lived.
What was the experience like to go there and see this memorial that was built for you, for all the guys on your crew, for all the guys you knew during the war?
Brought me almost to tears, like I say, to see every state represented. It dwarfed all the other memorials there. Really, they did an outstanding job.
And you made reference to this already, but when you walk over to the center of that memorial and there's a fountain and right behind it are 4,000 gold stars, each one representing 100 lives of Americans in World War II. It sounds like that's the part that maybe brought you to tears.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. When I think how many we lost there, and even Vietnam wasn't as bad, Korea wasn't as bad, but still loss of life, useless loss of life in those places. I felt World War II was the ultimate, and we should have never engaged in any other ground war. Give them air support, that's great, but don't put our people on the ground anymore.
And you've been on the honor flight now. You mentioned volunteering at the VA 2 days a week, and I understand you're trying to sign other guys up to go on the next honor flight, huh?
Absolutely. I have a stack of applications in my desk drawer there, and whenever I see a World War II guy with a hat on, I go approach him and get him an application if he wants to go. Some are fearful that they can't make it, they're in a wheelchair. And I said, don't worry about that. They'll take care of everything for you.
I imagine there's some World War II veterans listening right now that have thought about putting in an application and they're not sure it's for them. What would you tell them that makes that trip, that honor flight, worthwhile for a veteran?
It shows that people still honor World War II veterans for what they did. They spend a lot of money on the memorial for us, giving back something to us for what we did.
How many kids and grandkids you got?
I had 2 daughters and a son, and one of my daughters died. 4 granddaughters, 1 great-granddaughter, 2 grandsons.
A lot of people who wouldn't be here if you didn't make it home from the war and you didn't survive prison camp, when you think about that, you think about your grandkids and great-grandkids and other people that age. What do you think they need to know about World War II and what all you guys did?
Like I said before, the loss of life, committing ground troops to any war is ridiculous. We don't want to see any more loss of life. No more Iraq, no more Afghanistan, no more South Korea. Like I say, we'll give them air support, but that's it. That's what I want them to ensure after I'm gone. Always vote against that. Anybody that wants to commit our soldiers.
What would you say you're most thankful for?
Well, my longevity, I guess, to see all my kids grow up.
Did spending 7 months as a prisoner of war give you a different perspective on life once you got back?
Yeah, it made me appreciate all the little things in life, like having a warm place to sleep, good food, take a shower.
Don't take anything for granted anymore, huh?
That's right. If you got that, you got just about everything you really need. The rest is just superfluous.
Well, I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for what you're still doing for veterans today at the VA. Is there anything else you think we ought to know?
Not right now. Can't think of anything.
Fair enough. That is Al Porta, 90 years old of Reno, Nevada. Quite the story he has, and what a heart for veterans he has to continue volunteering at Reno's VA. He's 90 years old, but he goes there every week helping blind veterans learn how to bowl and golf, among other things. I don't know about you, but hearing stories like the one Al told us today, that's inspiring to me. And when it comes to Honor Flight and the idea of starting a hub here in the Central Valley to honor our veterans in Fresno County, Madera County, Merced, Kings, Tulare counties, and beyond, I know that we can make this happen. So get a hold of me. paul@kmjnow.com is the email address. We heard from John Yuspa of Honor Flight Nevada at the beginning of the program. I want to congratulate him. He got an award from Southwest Airlines as their Volunteer of the Year because of his work with Honor Flight. To me, it's encouraging to see how quickly Honor Flight Nevada got up and running and what motivated people on a mission can do when they all work together. So I'm excited to see what unfolds over the weeks ahead here. Next week, we're going to hear from an 88-year-old World War II veteran who has written a new book on Fresno's military history during World War II. He has a little bit of experience with the written word. He only spent 33 years at the Fresno Bee. George Gruner finished there as the executive editor. We're going to hear from him next week. Looking forward to that. Thanks for spending your Saturday afternoon with us today. Join us again next week for another installment of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.